This is Company Cars, the podcast that tries to make sense of the car business. Hello, and welcome to another episode of Company Cars. This episode is a follow-up episode to an earlier one we did about auto shows and the role they play in automotive marketing and how that role has changed over time. So, also, sorry about the delay in episodes. My life the past couple weeks has been a little bit crazy in my day job, so I haven't had a chance to really visit the podcast in a few weeks, but we're here now, and so hopefully you enjoyed the past month and that you're having a great start to your spring. So the past 2 years or so have been really brutal for auto shows, and the past 2 years have been brutal primarily because of the pandemic. So auto shows have historically been large gatherings in indoor venues, and these are probably really strong super spreader events. In addition, people are getting in and out of cars and touching a lot of surfaces, and although there doesn't seem to be a lot of issues with surface transmission, it's still not the ideal environment during a global pandemic. So, understandably, we haven't really had indoor auto shows over the past 2 years, and most auto shows were canceled between March 2020 and late 2021, with a couple of exceptions here and there, some of which were adaptations to an outdoor space, some of which had mask mandates or vaccine mandates. But in 2022, many of these auto shows are beginning to think about their return and what format they'll return as in this strange post-pandemic market environment where cars are in short supply, demand seems unlimited, and there's not a lot of need to do a ton of marketing. And with these auto shows returning, it was a really good opportunity to visit two of them, the one in New York and the one in Austin, which have historically been very different, as we discussed in an earlier episode. And the key here is I wanted to get a feel for how each has changed since the pre-pandemic version of each, as I had been to both in 2019 as well. So on this episode, we'll also discuss another rental car roulette experience, this time with a BMW, which is pretty exciting. And we'll talk a little bit about some unusual choices you might be seeing in the rental car aisle this year and next year. So we'll start our conversation with the New York Auto Show. So to kick things off for our conversation, I recently went to the 2022 New York Auto Show, which was the first time in 3 years the show has been held, with the last time being in 2019. So the New York Auto Show is generally considered the last major auto show of the cycle, and it occurs around Easter weekend in March or April each year. It's anchored to Easter, so as Easter moves around, the dates of the New York Auto Show moves as well. And by the time Easter rolled around in 2020, we were at the height of the pandemic-era lockdowns. We were all sheltering in place, not wanting to leave our homes, trying to conserve masks for medical professionals. And so the New York Auto Show was going to be a non-starter, and it was first rescheduled for fall 2020 when everybody thought the pandemic would be a short-term thing, and then it was canceled again, and it was canceled for 2020, canceled for 2021, and then the organizers in mid to late 2021 decided that they felt confident enough that they could return in 2022. So this year was our first year back, and the way the show turned out and was presented definitely reflects a lot of the challenges tied to the pandemic and supply chain disruptions associated with the post-pandemic era automotive market. So in prior years, most major automakers were in attendance, if not at the manufacturer level, where the manufacturer would send vehicles, reps, and spend money on an elaborate display, then at the local New York Tri-State Dealers Association level, because dealers found the New York Auto Show a fantastic opportunity to connect with consumers, generate sales leads, and get their product in front of people. So the New York Tri-State area is a really important new vehicle market for all the major automakers. And so there are lots of really large and really high volume dealerships in the area. So it's a great opportunity. But 2022 is very different. And so we've had several episodes where we talk about how the market has changed. And right now, most dealers and manufacturers are struggling to meet demand and have enough cars to meet demand from new car shoppers. Many automakers and dealer associations considered it not really worth the effort or money to participate in the New York Auto Show this year, with the logic being, why would we spend any money on marketing and use cars that we maybe don't have available to go to an auto show to drum up leads when we don't really need to drum up leads right now? People are naturally going to their dealerships and often willing to pay really high sums and above MSRP to secure a car. So the need for marketing is a bit muted this year, and that was reflected in the large number of automakers that were absent from the show. So most of the European automakers were absent, so there was no Audi, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, Jaguar, Land Rover present at the auto show. Volkswagen was there, but they were the only European automaker that I recall being at the auto show. And also, Honda wasn't there. And this was really interesting because Honda is a very popular brand and their cars are always of interest to general buyers, but they also faced pretty severe supply chain constraints, in some cases more so than many other automakers, over the past 6 to 12 months, and so they didn't really have cars to show. And the other automakers that were there tended to bring just a small selection of their portfolios based on what they were trying to highlight or trying to show the general public about the direction of the brand. So for example, General Motors only brought vehicles from the Chevrolet brand, and so they did not bring any Buicks, any GMCs, or any Cadillacs. And Hyundai, Kia, each were represented, but they did not bring any products or set up a display for their luxury Genesis division, which they've historically spent a lot of time and energy to promote because Genesis is a relatively new brand. And even amongst the automakers who showed up, they substantially scaled down the intricacy of their displays, and many automakers forwent the multi-level displays with water features and extreme lighting and music and free stuff in favor of the standard carpeting on the floor and QR codes all over the place so guests could just scan on their phone to get more information. So the automakers who were there spent a lot less money on their displays. And one interesting consequence of scaled down displays and fewer participants is that the automakers who did participate this year were able to secure substantially more floor space for their products to spread out. And this allowed many automakers to make their displays more interactive and more engaging with the people who did come. So building on the previous episode about auto shows, where we talked about the interactive element of auto shows and this being a growing trend, there were several automakers that had interactive ride-along events where visitors could ride with a professional driver on a dedicated track to learn more about specific cars. And this was also possible because the auto show this year was focused very heavily on electric vehicles, which have no tailpipe emissions, and thus you could drive these around indoors without any worries about carbon monoxide poisoning or air quality issues. So that was really neat to see the auto show become much more interactive. And actually, there was a display in one section of the Javits Center where they had set up EVs from several different brands on the same track. So they shared one track, and then you could just hop from EV to EV in different lines and try several different EVs at the same time, which I thought was a pretty innovative use of space that would otherwise go empty, because historically automakers would fill the space, but with fewer automakers this year, they had some extra space to play with as the show organizers. And so I thought that was pretty neat to experience as well. So the show's increased focus on these interactive displays and interactive exhibits was definitely really interesting, especially because it coincides with this focus on switching to electric vehicles. And so there was still the traditional Camp Jeep outside the Javits Center, which has been going on for a very long time, and the Toyota test track right next to it. But a lot of the focus on the entire show in general was about battery electric vehicles. And the general feeling at the show was that battery electric vehicles represented the future of the car business. And in many ways, automakers were trying to highlight ways in which these cars were superior to their gasoline counterparts. So many of the displays with EVs touted the performance benefits of these cars, the lower maintenance costs, and of course the no need for gasoline. And it was clear that electric vehicles in general were the star of the New York Auto Show. And so, for example, Ford had an F-150 Lightning exhibit where you could get in the truck and they would show you different features about the truck and take it out on a track and show you its speed. So there were a lot of displays that talked about the performance benefits of EVs. And I think that is what will help drive adoption of EVs, is showing that these cars are faster, quieter, and less expensive to own over the long run than their gasoline counterparts, even if they're more expensive to purchase upfront right now. In addition, having fewer automakers show up opened up the opportunity for a couple startup automakers to participate. And this occasionally happens every couple years at the Detroit Auto Show. We'll see a couple startup automakers show up and try to test the waters for their display and gauge public interest in what they're doing. But this year, one company in particular, VinFast, a Vietnamese automaker that's a division of a broader Vietnamese conglomerate, had this very large display at the New York Auto Show on the main floor and brought its full lineup that they say they're bringing to the U.S. later this year. And this display was also of great interest to a lot of people because it's a brand new automaker and they seem to be coming out guns blazing. And they also have this unique quirk to their business model where they are trying to push this cell phone style purchase and subscription model for the electric vehicles. And the idea here is you buy the car at roughly the same price as an internal combustion equivalent. So the model they brought, I think it was the VinFast 8, they were aiming for a price of around $40,000. And then you pay a monthly subscription fee to use the battery for a fixed amount of distance each year. So there's different monthly fees based on how many miles you want to drive. And VinFast will know this because all the cars are connected to their system and they can track your mileage. And so the idea here is the automaker retains control and responsibility for the battery. And so if the battery degrades too quickly or the performance declines, VinFast would be responsible for replacing the battery versus you as the consumer. And so it'll be interesting to see how this new twist to vehicle ownership will come through and how people will take to it. It definitely seems something that some people were interested in because it lowers the entry price point for getting into an electric vehicle. And that's probably the largest hurdle out there for EVs. But it'll be interesting to see if the price can stick because there's a lot of affordable EVs coming in the next several years, allegedly, according to those automakers. And some of these planned products will probably undercut the VinFast products in price. And so it'll really come down to whether VinFast can convince consumers that not owning a battery is a good idea and that you can always upgrade to the latest battery if you're just subscribing to it. So you can kind of swap out the parts and keep the car, but get a new battery. And so it'll be interesting to see where they go. I think they're currently taking reservations and pre-orders for the car, and so it would be interesting to hear about it. But overall, the New York Auto Show this year reflected the shift in the marketplace brought on by the pandemic and the broader shift in the automotive business as we transition to electric vehicles. So there were fewer cars as a reflection of our current supply chain issues. There were more interactive exhibits with things that you couldn't do online from home. And there was a focus on a future that is clearly electric and zero tailpipe emissions. So many automakers and dealers chose not to participate this year and didn't see the value in coming. And those who did participate took advantage of the greater floor space to implement more interactive exhibits and engage consumers and shoppers in ways that are really difficult to do online or virtually. And now it's time for a short break. We'll hear from our sponsors and we'll share some information about how to submit a listener question. The Company Cars podcast is sponsored by Rejected Conjectures Incorporated, a division of Integrated Derivatives. If you have a question that you want answered on the show, write us an email at companycarspodcast@gmail.com. And the week immediately after returning from New York, the Austin Auto Show was held in Austin, where I live, and it seemed like a good opportunity to compare and contrast how a larger show has shifted and how a smaller show has shifted. And the big difference between the two, besides the size, is that New York is typically a larger show with substantial manufacturer support, And Austin is a show that's predominantly run by the local dealership association and the local dealers in the area. So while the Austin Auto Show also hasn't been held since 2019 as well, the 2022 show was actually very similar to the 2019 one. And in many ways, this reflects the naturally more casual, lower cost nature of the Austin show, as the local dealership association bears the burden of the cost. And so they've never really spent a lot on super elaborate displays or really crazy exhibits. And so what's interesting here is that at this show, while there were some electric cars and there were some pre-production electric cars that haven't come out yet, including the Kia EV6 and Subaru Solterra, they were not quite as prominently highlighted as they were in New York. And this is perhaps a reflection of local market tastes and the fact that a large number of EVs that are on the market now are vehicles that are either not available to dealers yet, are in extremely short supply, like the Ford Mustang Mach-E and the Ford F-150 Lightning. And similar to 2019, there was a ride and drive exhibit, but instead of having several automakers, so in 2019, I think there was Ford, Toyota, Mazda, and Chrysler represented at the ride and drive exhibit. This year, it was just Stellantis, aka the former Chrysler. And there were signs for a Mazda ride and drive, but I couldn't find them. And so maybe it was just Stellantis and Mazda pulled out at the last minute, or it was in a strange location. And this reduction in the ride and drive exhibit, it probably reflects a reduced marketing budget from automakers, as these test drive exhibits are generally sponsored by the manufacturer and funded with funds that the manufacturer sets aside for marketing promotions. And so what they'll do is they'll send a fleet, they'll send an event management team that's outsourced on the road with these cars traveling to all of these smaller auto shows to run the ride and drive exhibit. And so it's not quite as dependent on the local dealers association. And so the mix of automakers in attendance also reflected the dealers, who are relatively strong in Austin compared with the rest of the nation. So we had several automakers that participated in the Austin Auto Show that were not present in New York, and this included Mazda, Mercedes-Benz, and Nissan, for example, were here. And so although Nissan was also in New York, they had a much bigger display in Austin than I expected, and the other automakers that were present that had the most prominent displays, notably Kia and Subaru, were also automakers that had a presence in New York, but in Austin they had an outsized presence. And so because these automakers are stronger in the local market and these dealerships are relatively large given the size of the Austin market. And what's interesting to note here is we have a hometown automaker in Austin, and that's Tesla, and they did not participate in the Austin Auto Show, but they never participate in auto shows at all. This is not a response to the pandemic or a reflection of the supply chain issues, but it's just a reflection of Tesla's corporate-wide policy to spend zero on marketing efforts, and they focus primarily on word-of-mouth marketing, general consumer awareness, Elon Musk tweeting about the product on Twitter, and so they don't spend anything on marketing, and so they just don't go to auto shows. That's just a policy. And the takeaway here is that the Austin Auto Show in 2022 was very similar to the one in 2019, I think as a reflection of the different focus of Austin versus New York, where the Austin one is primarily about local dealers showing people cars and getting people to think about their product and come in and talk to them later. And there's still a lot of strong interest in that in the Austin market, because we're a growing economy, we're absorbing a lot of people from other metro areas, some of whom maybe didn't own cars before and now need to buy a car since they've moved to Austin. So it was pretty similar. And so maybe this difference in how the shows have evolved or not evolved since 2019 is maybe reflective in a way of also how each location has handled the pandemic and the world post-pandemic. And now it's time for Rental Car Roulette. On this occurrence of Rental Car Roulette, we have a very fascinating turn of events, at least to me. And so I was in Atlanta in late February and needed a rental car. So I decided to swing by Hertz, my favorite rental car company. They've been in the news a little bit because they have some issues with calling the police on people that they think have not returned their rental car. And there's actually a really easy way to make sure this doesn't happen to you. And that would be when you return the car. Now I always take pictures of the car sitting in the Hertz return lane that's time stamped. And that way that serves as proof that I've returned the car. And so that should help if you're asked later why you didn't return a car. And this happens when either you extend your rental and it doesn't get recorded correctly, or you return it to a location and the car doesn't get scanned in, because Hertz in their IT system doesn't have a mechanism to identify that two people cannot be renting the same car at the same time. And so if your car is not scanned in when you're done with the rental, whether by accident or somebody just forgetting your car, and then goes out on a different rental, Hertz's system allows both of you to have this car at the same time. So if you're really worried about it, you can try to make sure that your car gets scanned in. So Hertz has stopped providing printed receipts, and that used to be a way to make sure that your car was scanned in, because if they print you the final paper receipt, they had to scan the car in. But now they've moved to a system where they don't give the return agents the printer anymore, the handheld printer that prints out the receipt. If you want a receipt, you have to go back inside and ask for the receipt. But the person that has the tool to close out the rental has that there. And so the key is to make sure that your car is going to get scanned. So if you have time before your flight, I would make sure that it's pretty clear your car is going to be scanned in, or that you see your car be scanned in. So even if you don't get the electronic receipt immediately, as long as it's scanned in, you'll get it eventually. And so sometimes it's taken me a day and a half to get the receipt, because I think it relies upon the scanning machine being linked back up to the system. And so if they're taking a system and they're scanning a bunch of cars in and they forget to dock it correctly, then it may not show up for a while. So as long as the car is scanned in, you should be okay. But that's dealing with Hertz, and such is the nature of dealing with them. But anyway, I showed up at Hertz Atlanta, which is a location notorious for a terrible selection in cars. And historically, I've gotten pretty lucky before, pre-pandemic, the couple times I've rented from Hertz Atlanta. I've gotten a Cadillac ATS before. I've gotten a Buick Regal Sportback and a few other interesting things. And so people like to dump on Hertz Atlanta and say they have terrible selection, but I've gotten lucky a few times. And so I showed up, and there were lots of interesting choices when I got there on a Thursday night. And so I took a 2019 Honda CR-V that had about 62,000 miles on the odometer. And normally this kind of mileage on a car would be a disqualifier for me, because when a rental car gets to 62,000 miles, it usually needs pretty severe reconditioning, because rental cars live a pretty tough life. But this car was pristine. I walked around it. There were some small cosmetic issues outside, but the car was very clean. The car had clearly been well taken care of before. And the other thing that caught my eye about this car was that it was a Honda. And this may be a conversation for a different episode, but Hondas are rarely, if ever, found in rental car fleets, because they have a corporate policy at the Honda North America level to never sell cars directly into rental fleets. So they do have a fleet division, but they don't sell cars to rental car companies as a policy. So any Hondas you see in anybody's rental car fleets are bought retail, one car at a time, by the rental car companies. And so historically, you would sometimes see like a CR-V here or there, or like a Civic or an Accord, but they were pretty rare, especially at Hertz. So it was super interesting to see the CR-V there. And this means that Hertz bought the car at retail, which is pretty interesting. And what was even more interesting is, upon looking at the car further, this car was a car that it seemed like Hertz had bought used. So in 2021, as the supply chain shortages intensified and new car companies weren't making that many cars, they were prioritizing their retail customers over their fleet customers, because rental car companies typically get large discounts for buying large quantities of cars at once, as discussed in our previous episode about rental car company economics. And so the rental car companies had sold off a large chunk of their fleets at the beginning of the pandemic because they didn't think travel was going to come back. And suddenly, when travel rebounded in 2021, really suddenly, they didn't have enough cars. And so they had to go to the retail market to buy cars. And this was unprecedented, but most of the major rental car companies decided that they were going to go to the used car market and buy clean 1 to 2 year old used cars to rent out, in addition to anything they could get their hands on new. And I looked at the back of this CRV, and it was one of these cars that Hertz had bought used because it still had the dealer stickers from a previous owner. And so when Hertz buys a car directly through its contracts with a manufacturer, yes, there's a dealer that processes the paperwork, but you won't see like a dealer sticker on the back. So you see these on cars all the time when you buy a car from a dealership and they want to advertise that you bought the car there. So they put a sticker that says like CarMax or Toyota of Nashville or Toyota of North Austin on the back of the car. And so this car still had a dealer sticker from a previous owner, which would never happen with a rental car that Hertz buys new. So this was another hint. And the last hint that this was a car that Hertz had bought used was that this car had a Tennessee license plate. And based on how Tennessee license plates are issued, I could tell that it was a brand new Tennessee license plate. So this was really strong evidence that this was a car that Hertz had bought recently. And so I was pretty excited about this car, and I get to the exit gates, and the attendant asks me the current odometer reading on the car, which is pretty standard operating procedure because Hertz also doesn't really have a good system for tracking the mileage of each car at a consolidated level. So every time a car goes out, oftentimes you'll be asked for the odometer reading because they need to key it into their system to have your start mileage and your end mileage. And even though they have this in a separate system, their lane checkout, I don't think that system talks to this other system that has their data. But anyway, so I tell the attendant the mileage, and the attendant starts to freak out. And this was strange for two reasons. One, my experience has been that most Hertz gate attendants don't really care. I mean, they're just here to make sure that your ID matches the name on the reservation and to key in a mileage and to get the gate to open so you can move on. They also ask if you want to prepay for gas because they get a small commission if you say yes. So the second thing that was interesting is that the attendant said that this car had never had an oil change in its life, which is absolutely not true, because if you have never changed the oil in a car for 62,000 miles, I don't think that car would be able to be driven out of the Hertz gates without any major issues. And this car had no major issues and warning lights. I think what the attendant meant was the car had never had an oil change at Hertz. And so in their system, because at some point, maybe the odometer had not been keyed in anywhere in their system, or there's just no record of the car because they had just bought it. And so there's no record of what maintenance has been done to the car. So the system said the car could not be rented out because it was due for service immediately. Because the idea is that, oh, wow, it's overdue for maintenance. I guess they must have had zero as the start odometer or something, or they either didn't have that data or the systems weren't talking to each other. And so this tripped a code in the system that says the car couldn't be rented out. And so I had to go back. I had to turn around and go back to the lot to search for a different car. And I was really frustrated because I had spent about 20 minutes adjusting everything in the car to my settings, changing all the radio presets, getting the seat to where I want it to be, setting up my phone, and it was frustrating to have to start over. And also, there wasn't really a ton of other stuff I was super interested in, but when I got back, I did see a very interesting car that somebody had just pulled up, and this was a 2019 BMW 4 Series, and so specifically a 430i Grand Coupe. And so Grand Coupe is a very confusing label. This car has four doors, so it's not a two-door car. And it has this like sloping roof line with a hatchback on the back. And so it looked really cool. But this car was also notable for several reasons. One, Hertz and Hertz Atlanta in particular rarely puts BMWs into the aisle to choose whatever you want because they try to rent these out in the special BMW category and get more money for them than they would get on, say, just a standard midsize car reservation. And the other thing that was interesting about the BMW was this one was a pre-pandemic car that Hertz had chosen to keep through the pandemic. And so how did I know this? Interestingly enough, this car also had a Tennessee license plate, and based on the order of how Tennessee issues license plates, I could tell this was probably from around mid-2019-ish that the license plate was issued. And also, this car didn't have any dealer stickers or anything on it, and this car had 46,000 miles on the odometer, and so which is less than the CRV, but this car was pretty beat up for a BMW. So this car had a lot of curb rash, had some dents, had some dings, had some scrapes, and the interior smelled terrible. It definitely smelled like somebody had smoked a joint or several joints or maybe even hotboxed in the car prior to me. And this didn't deter me from the car. I'm sure it would deter a lot of people because I was just curious about the BMW. I haven't driven a BMW in a long time, and I was curious about how a modern BMW would drive. And the best way I would describe how the car drove is that it was such a Jekyll and Hyde type of car. So on one level, this car was incredibly athletic and playful on the highway and a lot of fun to drive fast. But this car also had some really frustrating flaws about it that made me just wonder what BMW was thinking when they designed this car. And so one, this car didn't have any advanced driver assistance features. So it didn't have lane departure warning. It may have had forward collision warning, but it didn't have adaptive cruise control. I think it did have blind spot monitors, and it had parking sensors, but it didn't have a lot of the features that I would expect in a $50,000 car new. And this would be a deal breaker for me. Like, I would not have bought this BMW new, or I would not have leased it. Two, this particular BMW does not have Android Auto. So BMW did not add Android Auto to its cars until they were being redesigned throughout the late 2010s. So they had Apple CarPlay, but they didn't have Android Auto. And so I have an Android phone, and so basically I couldn't really use my phone in the manner that I would expect for a car from 2019, especially a luxury car. And the third thing that made this car a deal breaker is the controls in this car were incredibly frustrating, and it took me days to really figure out and learn how to communicate and interact with the car. And that's a long time. So I have driven a decent chunk of cars from Hertz over the years, and so I think I have a pretty reasonable grasp of where things are laid out in a car and where to look for certain things, and this car just took me forever to figure out. And somebody before me had changed the settings in the navigation system to avoid highways. And in Atlanta, you kind of need to drive on the main 7585 artery to get from the airport to anywhere north of town. And so the navigation system was routing me this really strange way. And so if I hadn't been from Atlanta, I might have followed those directions, and who knows where it would have taken me. But the car was fantastic to drive. I mean, it handled well, the engine sounded great, and it was a lot of fun, especially on the highway. And it was one of those cars where you don't realize how fast you're going until you look down at your speedometer. And it was just really playful and always willing to give you more. But these flaws that just drove me nuts about the car were collectively fatal, in my opinion, especially at this price point, because brand new, the 430i was a $50,000 car. And even before the inflated used car market of today, this would be easily a $36,000 or $37,000 used car. And the car was fine, and I enjoyed driving it, but I don't think I would spend my own money on a 430i, whether new or used, because it's just missing a lot of features that come standard in a Toyota Corolla or Honda Civic these days. And it's ridiculous that BMW doesn't make these features standard in a modern luxury car. And so I have higher expectations for BMW because it drove really well, but really it should have more features. And from a feature standpoint, this car wasn't really luxurious at all. It was pretty basic and pretty Spartan inside. Like, my car had heated seats and it had the the Sensatec upholstery, so it had the fake leather, but it didn't have a high-end audio system, so the audio system just sounded pretty normal. It didn't have really a really large screen or really well laid out gauges. It had the standard BMW gauges that have been around since the 2000s, and while they're great and they're beautiful, they're definitely a bit outdated at this point, and I'm expecting a little more from the car. And also, this car was pretty beat up for 46,000 miles, and yes, rental cars live a pretty difficult life, but I would have expected BMW build quality to have lasted a little bit longer than this. And so I was seeing clear signs of interior wear on trim pieces, and of course all the bumps and scrapes. That has nothing to do with BMW, but has more to do with Hertz. But I was surprised that some parts of the interior were already starting to wear out. So this was a fun car to rent. This is not a car that I would probably buy for myself, and nor would it be a car that I would recommend to somebody else buying a compact luxury car in this space. I think if somebody were buying a compact luxury car in this space, I would probably recommend a Mercedes C-Class over a BMW 3 Series or 4 Series, maybe an Audi A5 Sportback, if you have to have that like hatchback sleek shape of the 430i, or perhaps a Genesis G70. So anyway, this was a really fun rental car roulette to talk about. And so thankfully, Hertz had some really interesting cars this time around. And that's the part of the roulette wheel, right? Like sometimes it's choose your color Nissan Altima, which is perfectly fine, but I've driven enough Nissan Altimas and they're all kind of the same. And so sometimes, other times, you get these really fun and interesting things that I otherwise wouldn't really have an opportunity to experience outside of Hertz. And so that's kind of why I keep renting from them, even though they're kind of difficult to deal with sometimes. But such is life. You can't win them all. So thanks for listening to this segment of Rental Car Roulette. And thank you for listening to this episode of Company Cars. Hope you really enjoyed this episode, and hope you're looking forward to our next one, which will hopefully come sooner than a month and a half. And don't forget to send in all your suggestions, questions, and ideas to our email address at companycarspodcast@gmail.com. Our Instagram handle is companycarspodcast, and we'll chat again soon.